Welcome. Well, everybody's favorite topic, bodhicitta. Have you heard about this bodhicitta before? The awakening mind, the aspiration that creates a bodhisattva. It's a thought. It's an aspiration. It's a wish. To free all beings from suffering without limit in the numbers of beings and without limit in the extent of the suffering, really wanting all beings throughout space and time to be completely free and at ease in a stable, ongoing way. Wanting that and willing to do whatever it takes for the one with this aspiration to enact such an awesome aspiration, which in this tradition means the best way to do this is to practice this way and realize the awakening of a Buddha and bring all beings to this awakening of a Buddha so that they can keep also benefiting others. So it's really just all coming out of compassion. It starts with compassion. It's more than just compassion, but it's based on compassion. Compassion and understanding suffering and understanding practice. And we all have compassion and already, so that's the good news. That's something that we all always share. For some, we're less aware of it than others. Sometimes we get confused how it works, but we all have it in one form or another, and it manifests throughout our lives and in different ways. I think just when we're open and just paying attention to those around us, we feel it more. Like I was recently just remembering as a kid, I don't know how old I was, maybe like 10 or something. And we grew up on Long Island Sound, on the water there. And my brother and I liked to fish for snappers. And learning how to do that as kids and sometimes bringing them home and learning how to fry them. And of course it's wonderful to interact with the mysterious and wild world of nature like this. We liked it doing this, and then at some point, pretty early on like that, I think it's in the process of watching the snapper flipping around on the dock where we bring it up, and where it's, you know, has gills kind of expand like it's suffocating, and watching it kind of like panting and then just ceasing. And maybe a few times watching that and thinking like, this, I don't know about this. People were fishing all around, right? And it seemed like a normal thing. So I did it too. But just without anybody ever mentioning anything about it, just watching this fish, it was like, I don't think that I'm so into continuing to do this. And I think it was maybe right around the time that my kind parents had given my brother and I, my brother and I always got the same everything. And we were spoiled kids. So we kind of graduated to like the bigger size fishing rods, kind of expensive with a nice kind of reel and stuff. And just as we had just recently gotten these, I think, and when I had this kind of insight, I think it was like an awakening of compassion, feeling like, this looks painful, and I'm like the main pain causer here. And how hard that was to tell my parents, this is such, it was such a nice gift that you got. And I don't think I can do it anymore. And I think they weren't like distraught, but maybe disappointed. They were encouraging this sport for their kids. And I think then we had the fishing rods in the basement for some years, and at some point cleaning stuff out in a sale, and we're like, well, you guys are never going to use these again. I think my brother stopped too at some point. And so we might as well sell them. And I'm still kind of a pretty young kid thinking, but if we sell them to somebody else, then they'll do the same thing. Shouldn't we just get rid of them? These expensive, virtually brand new fishing rods. I can't remember what we actually did, but I think that was I was promoting, let's just get rid of them. This is hard for my parents to understand. And again, I think the interesting thing is, we maybe all have some moments like this, interacting with animals as kids and so on. And, you know, society rolls along in its way where we don't question these things. And maybe it's harder to kind of see things so freshly when we're older, because we're more, well, of course, it's just the way it is. Sometimes as kids, we have kind of like, have these little awakenings, or little kind of like fresh views. But why? I know it's the way it is, everyone's doing, but why? So, I think compassion's a completely natural thing. The more we hear about it, we can think about it and cultivate it, but I think it's also just paying attention. It naturally comes forth. It's in our heart. It's basic. I think it comes from like feeling a connection to other living beings, which we are connected. We don't need to make that, but sometimes we feel it. I recently heard this teaching. Actually, this was an article someone gave me from Scientific American, the November issue this month, about meditation. Meditation's the cover story, the scientific benefits of meditation. And y'all probably know there's lots of merging now of research, scientific research on the effects with the EEG and basically studying the brain. It's an interesting article that I won't get fully into, but it talks about different types of meditations that have different effects on the brain, all within Buddhism. Like focused attention meditation that they work with, like following the breath in a focused way is one type. Mindfulness of body feelings and mental states and so on is a different kind, with different effects on the brain, actually. Loving kindness and compassion meditations we don't talk about so much in Zen as specific meditations, but they can be cultivated and light up different parts of the brain, and kind of like spacious awareness meditation, not focused on any object, also has different effects. And the article goes through these effects, but Matthieu Ricard, some of you might know, is a Western Tibetan monk and scientist involved in these things. And he really wanted to get into the nuance of the differences between empathy and compassion. Sometimes I think of like the same thing. But he's defining empathy as where you just, you identify with another person and their feelings. You like, you feel the feelings of another. You resonate with, you know, somebody's upset or really happy, and it's contagious, right? Or maybe that's not the word. It's more like we really can feel others, right? Again, just because we're connected, we naturally have this kind of empathy. And he says, compassion in the dharmic understanding is not merely just empathy. It is empathy. It's based on empathy, but it's also based on really feeling others' feelings. It's also then wanting them to be free from suffering, to wanting them to be well, and wanting to help, actually, wanting to help them be free. They found that actually when people were in various experiments, you could generate empathy in people, and then in meditators, you could generate compassion. The meditators for the study, they, scientists need like standards, right? So the expert meditators had to have 10,000 hours of meditation practice. So I was calculating, I think that'd be like 3 40-minute periods every day for 20 years. Or I think Charlie figured out the math of like 8 hours a day with no kinhin for every day for 5 years. So that found some people.
Weekends off and 2 weeks off.
Okay, oh yeah, weekends off. That's right, 40-hour week.
Fast track.
Right. So I thought, in itself, I thought that was kind of interesting that they're like, that these benefits of meditation, it's not like a quick thing, unfortunately.
You know, my friend, another musician that we practice every week, and he's a scientific guy, you know, he works, and he said that he read a report about mastery in general.
Mm-hmm.
Requires 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. That point of
somebody just told me there's, I think, a kind of a new book out called Mastery, and it's based on the 10,000-hour theory across many different fields.
Yeah.
Artists and musicians. I don't think the book maybe mentions meditators, but maybe that's where they got the number. And you know, I think it's interesting over time, because I find, if I tried calculating, I think I'm about probably 10,000 hours when I think of the time, the days that I skip meditation, but then all the sesshins over the years, something around there. And I think like even just, you know, in the last year or so, my meditation changes. It's like, I think there's no end to this. There's no end. I wouldn't consider myself like an expert. Because I feel like there's so much distraction. Something. I'm working on it. Yeah. I think actually 20,000 hours, maybe, for me anyway, maybe necessary. That's why we like to have a lot of sesshins here. We're talking about recently. You can speed up the process. Anyway, this. Yeah. I knew someone at Tassajara who was like kind of a newer student there, who was really into like, I really see, like, I just got to be meditating all the time. I really see how this works. And he had a little like timer, and he would just like on tea breaks, he'd go like, he'd rack up 10 minutes, you know. Yeah, just like quota, right. Well, that's part of this bodhicitta story too that I hope we can get into. Is what about gaining idea here? Anyway, they found some differences between empathy and compassion, and I thought the example that they brought up in this article, I thought was kind of nice. They said empathy actually often leads to, on its own, can lead to stress and burnout and exhaustion, interestingly. But compassion leads to energy, ease, and happiness. And the example that they mentioned was like a mother's and her son just went to the hospital with some accident, and empathy is like, of course, she feels really super concerned. I can't stand that he's suffering. And she's pacing up and down the hall, just totally fretting and worrying and getting burnt out and stressed. And compassion is like, she's holding his hand and saying, I'm with you, I'm here for you, I want you to be well, I'm here to help you. Which is also has empathy, but it's this extra step. And I thought that was an interesting example. Isn't that kind of neat? The compassion is this has this extra intention that could get sidetracked in a weird way too, and maybe get stressed because I want them to be happy and they're not. But I think it's like this kind of being with, wishing well and being with and feeling the suffering for these meditations is actually that it's reciting internally these classic phrases we've heard. May all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. That's how you actually generate compassion. Where was I going with this? Oh, I guess there's that difference between empathy and compassion. And compassion then is like the main basis for this bodhicitta, which is the wish, may they be happy, may they be free from suffering, and that little extra step of may I actually do everything I can to enable that. And then the understanding is the best thing I can do is to actually practice. This is where it might differ from different traditions. Let's see, wouldn't it be better to actually learn how to be a heart surgeon or something? I think that would be good too. But in this context, it's like really understanding the root causes of suffering and addressing them with everything along the way. Yes, Richard.
From our personal experience, and I think that idea of burning out because of empathy and compassion, really interests me. And I concluded that you will burn out if you don't include some wisdom ability of letting go as well of the outcome. Because if you're attached, if you're compassionate or empathetic, but really needs the change to happen, and
yep.
If it won't, you'll suffer.
Yeah.
Then that letting go part has to be in there, and then you might not have to go into denial.
That's a key part that often doesn't show up in the definitions of compassion, but I think that's true. It's this ongoing, untiring, just, it doesn't seem to be going well, but still, I'm not like flagging in my wish. I'm not giving up. And that's another way they sometimes talk about this bodhisattva vow, bodhicitta, is never giving up on any beings or abandoning beings. Which is a little bit like that, even when it really looks like it's not going well. So this is part of it. And then how we do it, this is like the aspiration. And we talk a lot about that. It looks like the tradition does too. And sometimes I think it can be frustrating because it's like, it's so abstract. What are we going to do? And I think this is intentional that the tradition is saying, really training the mind in this new way to really open the heart and the understanding more and more this way. And then the actions just naturally pour forth. I think that's my understanding of what they keep saying. Just cultivate your mind like this, and then what you do will naturally, it'll work out great. There is the teaching of, like, what is the bodhicitta enacted is these six paramitas. Still sounds a little bit abstract, but it's actually our practices, which are giving. Once you have this, once you want to do, I'm signed up for the Buddha program, what do? It's just these six paramitas, giving and giving and giving, and ethical conduct, meaning refraining from harm, patience, diligence, not giving up, keep going, meditative concentration, getting really stable and calm so we can look more clearly with all these other practices, and then finally prajnaparamita, the wisdom of realizing it's all completely empty of what we think it is, while totally wholeheartedly doing these other five. But here's in our Zen tradition, Dogen's teacher Ru Jing talking about compassion and bodhicitta being an aspect of zazen. Well, yeah, it's kind of unusual, I think, because we don't usually think this way. Because zazen, you're just being present and letting go of past and future and distractions. And so this is a little bit curious. Ru Jing says, the zazen of the arhats and pratyeka Buddhas, or the shravakas and pratyeka Buddhas, are these, you know, practitioners who are just want to be realize nirvana for themselves alone, saying that it is free from attachment. Their zazen is free from attachment, but it lacks all-embracing compassion. This is very different from the zazen of the Buddhas and ancestors, where all-embracing compassion and the vow to awaken all sentient beings is the highest priority. In the zazen, I find it interesting, he's talking about this. So he says, the very essence of the Buddhas and ancestors' zazen is the vow to accumulate or gather all Buddha qualities from the moment of arousing bodhicitta, or this aspiration for awakening, into the endless future. Buddhas and ancestors never forget or abandon sentient beings, but have compassion for all creatures, even insects, and make a constant effort to rescue them all, and they turn over whatever merit is produced by this to all sentient beings. Because of this vow, Buddhas and ancestors always practice zazen in the desire realm, in our everyday world of Jambudvipa, or this world, which has great opportunities for influencing cause and effect. Buddhas and ancestors practice this way life after life, world after world, and attain great flexibility of mind and heart. So interesting. In this ordinary world, the desire world, where desire is a main influence, and because it's a chance to influence cause and effect, I thought that maybe you could practice zazen in the formless realms, where there is no cause and effect happening, and there aren't, like, you can't help beings. We might say, well, how do we help them in zazen? And, you know, maybe a very practical answer, if I had this, imagine this, I would say, it's just zazen with a really open heart. It's just sitting zazen settled in the present moment, but our heart is open. And it might be a subtle difference. Might not be that much difference. I would maybe notice it, like, I'm settled, and I notice these things sometimes in zazen. Like, I'm feeling really spacious and open, but then, like, there's some kind of, like, people making, like, noise in the zendo, or outside the zendo. And instead of, like, my heart's just open to, like, well, there's sentient beings. This is the world of cause and effect. We're, like, in a complicated world here. And my heart starts being like, why is it getting so noisy in here? So, like, I think this is, like, my mind is kind of spacious and open, but my heart's starting to close to the other beings in the vicinity. Like, I think that's maybe one way we could hear Rujing's Zazen instruction is like, no, you're still just really open to all of that. It's hard. Whereas the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas just put in earplugs maybe or something. Or just like cut it off. Or they just like go and hit the person. Get out of here. No, they probably don't do that. But and interestingly, so he says they have this Zazen that's infused with great compassion for all beings. And they realize this great flexibility of mind and heart. It's this term, nyūshin, or like, sometimes it's translated as like, soft mind, or soft heart. And he's saying this to Dogen. This is Rujing talking to Dogen. And then Dogen bows and says, how do we realize this flexibility of mind and heart, this soft mind? Rujing says,
Zazen.
Yes. Or another classic thing that Rujing might say. Yeah, this is a Rujing. She knows Rujing well.
Great exposure.
That's what he says. Rujing says, to actualize the Buddhas and ancestors dropping off body and mind is the essence of this flexibility. That's why dropping off body and mind is called the mind seal of the Buddhas and ancestors. Dogen bowed. And then later, Dogen went back to Japan and in his earlier days, he talked about bodhicitta guidelines for studying the way. He says, this bodhicitta, the aspiration for awakening, has many names, but they all refer to this one mind. Ancestor Nagarjuna said, the mind that fully sees into the uncertain world of birth and death is called bodhicitta. So the mind that like sees this is all like in this birth and death business is all like in flux and uncertain and undependable. That's how you bring forth this wish to benefit beings and relieve them from suffering. Interestingly, and then Dogen says, if we maintain this mind can become the thought of awakening. Bodhicitta. Indeed, if you understand discontinuity, the notion of self does not come into being. Ideas of name and gain do not arise. Fearing the swift passage of the sunlight, practice the way as though saving your head from fire. Reflecting on this ephemeral life, make endeavor in the manner of Buddha. So, contemplating impermanence. Yeah. And later he also says in the Zui Monkey, Dogen talks about, he says, see, people in China, like, seems like some people realize the way and some don't. What's this depend on? I think he's maybe having a conversation. And he says, it doesn't depend on intelligence or skill or even 10,000 hours of meditation. He says at this point, he says, I believe that this, you know, realizing the way really depends only on whether one's aspiration is firmly determined or not. I think you could say, because from that, then everything else comes forth. A person who arouses true aspiration and practices as much as one's capacity allows will not fail to realize the way. Then he talks about if you're trying to steal a precious treasure or win over a beautiful woman or man, and you will not like get distracted from these tasks. You'll find every opportunity to accomplish them. So we should treat practice like with this kind of enthusiastic desire. And then it says, next, to arouse this aspiration, just think deeply in your heart of impermanence. Again, impermanence of the world. This is not a matter of meditating using some provisional method of contemplation. It's not a matter of fabricating in our heads that which does not really exist. Impermanence is truly the reality right in front of our eyes. We need not wait for some teaching from others, some proof from scripture, or some principle. Born in the morning, dead in the evening. A person we saw yesterday is no longer here today. These are the facts we see with our eyes and hear with our ears. Applying this to our own bodies and thinking of the reality of all things, that we expect to live for 70 or 80 years, we die when we must die. Nanette's mom just lived till 93, so some people make it a long time. Still, it comes to an end. Precious teacher, Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, very important teacher of Buddhism in America, is currently in a coma in a hospital and probably will not live. Yeah.
How old is he?
I don't know how old. Yeah.
He had a stroke.
He had a stroke, yeah. We'll chant for him, and also Natalie Goldberg is ill, and many senior Soto Zen teachers died this year. At our recent conference, we did a memorial for quite a few of them. It looks like this is what's happening in this world. So I think, yeah, of course, we've heard it many, many times, right? But I think for myself, I find it really works. It's not a pleasant thing to remember, but it generates my enthusiasm for practice. When I think about others passing and how we're going to help them before they go, and ourselves, and it really bring it home. I don't feel ready. I need 10,000 more hours. But I got to be careful, not for myself, but I think this would be beneficial for others. I feel my restrictions in being able to benefit others through my own lack of practice. I really feel that, and I think this is a point about gaining idea. It's not like sometimes it's expressed that way. The bodhicitta's the vow to become a Buddha, to realize awakening for the benefit of all beings, and it's like, oh, we're going to get this thing. But I think it's nice to consider that actually we could talk about what is awakening. It's not actually getting anything. It's more like we have this Buddha nature that's already totally ready to help in all possible ways, and ready to be like, just not suffer at all. It's not suffering, and it's compassionate. We have this teaching, and we have some sense maybe that when we're really settled, that's just there. We sometimes can access it. We don't create it. It's there. So it's more like, you could say, awakening is the process of not so much getting something we don't have, but more like removing something like extra. There is a process of doing something, I think, but it's more like that which obscures the Buddha nature, we like drop away and let go of. And it does seem to me, in my experience, that there is stuff like that. It seems to really like block it. It can be like feeling really like open and spacious, like this example, right? And then like all this, you know, all kinds of stuff, noise, stuff going on in zazen. I'm like, this spaciousness, it's like, it doesn't really go somewhere. It's there, but this like cloud of like habitual, old kind of like neurotic tendencies coming on. My zazen! This is my only chance! It's ruined. And like that stuff, I think it's possible to let go of. Sometimes we can catch it and actually let go. And there's the spaciousness is waiting there. Spaciousness isn't bothered by the noise, but I am. So I have to drop off me, let go of me. And here's another nice place where Dogen says, practitioners have to arouse this sincere aspiration at least once. It's kind of a funny idea that maybe like if we really kind of taste the flavor of that kind of selfless, I just give my life to like all beings, whatever it takes, and just going to practice this way and like forget myself and everything else. Sometimes we just tap into that a little bit. Maybe the once is like, that's enough that like, I trust that more than anything else. I'm going to just, now I got to practice it, but like more than once. But maybe really like get the feeling of it. For whatever reason, he says, we have to arouse this sincere aspiration at least once. What is this? Arousing such an aspiration means, in this case, thinking little of your own life, having deep compassion for all living beings, and entrusting your body and life to the Buddha's teaching. Well, that's a pretty good combination. Thinking little of your own life, not in a critical, doesn't matter kind of way, but just more like, shift this ratio. We take care of ourselves, but like, how can I help? Have compassion for all beings and entrust our body and life to the Buddha's teaching. Maybe like about bodhicitta and practice. If you've already aroused such an aspiration, protect it. Do not lose it even for a moment. It's impossible to realize Buddha Dharma without arousing such aspiration. And in the Dogen's essay that we're studying on Sunday class, he also talks about this, like, because there's a few things in this world that when they're born, they rarely come to fruition, like some kind of seed and some kind of, like, fish egg or something. He mentions these things in the world that, like, mostly they're born and they quickly die, and the third one is bodhicitta. It very rarely, like, lasts, so Dogen says, if you just have a tiny little like sense of it, you take really good care of it because it's very easily lost. It's not like, I got it, and now I can just relax and like it's going to take care of itself. In some ways, it does grow itself, but he's like, especially maybe at first, really we have to like water it and nurture it. And because I think the reason it's easily lost is because our habitual tendencies like are so strong. They're like, well, this is more important than that. These things are my little things I have to do for me are so strong. So this is the Dalai Lama. May he live long. He's getting old too. Whether we can arouse bodhicitta and how powerful it will be fundamentally depends on our compassion. All of us have compassion to a certain extent. When we think of someone suffering, we're naturally moved by this feeling of compassion, as we were saying. But now we take this compassion that we already possess and expand it until it's without any bias or restriction and becomes a courageous sort of compassion, infused with an extraordinary altruistic resolve that you yourself can and will free all beings from suffering and guide them toward awakening. This is what's meant by great compassion, which is the source of bodhicitta. So even the I can and will bring them to awakening, I guess he's saying, is not even quite bodhicitta yet. That's great compassion, but then you have to, and I will like go as far as it takes in this practice to do that. Which is a pretty radical statement. I mean, we recite these vows at the end of our talks. We're just saying, I myself, it's even in italics here, can in italics. I can do it. I can do it. And I will do it. You yourself. I mean, we might, you know, nuance this or speak about this. Like, well, what do you mean, you yourself? But I think the feeling, the spirit of it is like, I'm taking full responsibility, I think is what it is. And of course, with everyone's help, we can't do anything ourselves, really, right? But like, I'm willing to, like, I'm not going to hope somebody else does it for me. I'd like to help that, actually. Can't the Buddha come down and just help save everybody? And then we all rejoice. We're like, no, we have to do that. I think Robert Thurman, you maybe know, is a kind of creative and kind of radical teacher, the way he puts things sometimes. He talks in a little bit maybe kind of like provocative term. He translates the Bodhisattva vehicle, and the Bodhisattva is the messianic vehicle. I'm not sure exactly the definition of Messiah, but I think it's someone who's going to like save the world on their own, you know. Well, you know, I don't think we should adopt this term. It's a little bit too much, but he uses that. Dalai Lama says, now as long as we're concerned solely with ourselves and with the short term, thinking, how can I get ahead? What do I need? What should I have? Our scope remains very narrow. We find ourselves imprisoned in a cramped and claustrophobic state of mind, unable to bear even the slightest misfortune or discomfort. On top of that, we tend to shirk our responsibilities and blame others, announcing, oh, so-and-so didn't do what he should have done, or look what so-and-so is doing to me. And the tiniest difficulty is multiplied into many problems until there's no end to them. I thought, this sounds familiar. I relate to that. We will find that if we're only concerned about ourselves day in, day out, all kinds of misfortunes occur and our unhappiness only increases. But when we think of the welfare of others, our mind automatically becomes more spacious and excitement and sorrow will affect us less intensely. So if we think about this carefully, it will be apparent that when our motivation is to benefit others, our own welfare is taken care of as a matter of course. We will observe, too, that when we think of ourselves alone and neglect or discount others, we do not end up happy as a result. In fact, nothing's accomplished. It's a benefit to anyone. And we're still unhappy. This is strikingly clear. Oh. I mean, it's so true, isn't it? But like, wow. It's like, I forget this like most of the time. And he has this little, like, I don't know if he's this spontaneous like poem or if he's quoting someone else's, but it's like kind of verse form. He's saying, while I live, I will meditate on bodhicitta. This is what will give meaning to my life. At the moment of death, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will help me to continue onward on my way toward perfect awakening. When I'm thriving and happy, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will enable me to use my prosperity to serve others and avoid the pitfalls of pride, envy, and lack of respect. When I face failure and sadness, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will prevent me from losing heart and losing hope. So all the time and in any situation, in life, when death is near, in success or failure, in joy or sorrow, bodhicitta is something I cannot be without. Quite beautiful. And I've also heard, when I was expressing to some people, because we're really looking at bodhicitta these last few months, and I'm finding it hard, personally challenging, when it's kind of the way that it's talked about in the tradition, I just feel like it's so, I can feel like it's impossible. It just seems impossible. Sometimes maybe it seems like, no, I really can see. It's right here all the time. It always is possible. But when I'm self-involved, it seems far away. And I sometimes think, almost wanting to like escape the whole like practice and just do something else. Maybe not quite that far, but I'm confessing. I have personally, it's been hard. Or I've come across teachings recently that say, when you're really getting into thinking about it, this will happen. So I actually took heart and they say, you will, it's so awesome. You will feel like you can't go on with this. And at that time, that's when you just have to reinvigorate it. And you basically, the way you do it is you remember the suffering beings. It's not like, I have to do it. It's more like, no, they're still suffering. And it's getting worse. And where time is passing, my life's ending. And then, okay, I'll do it.
Well, here's a slightly different angle.
Yes.
Because I've certainly had that thought as well. And what I find is, sometimes I do try to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work.
That's a good one, too. Yep.
Because, you know, it's like, no, I just can't. Not that I shouldn't take the night off now and then. Of course.
Yeah.
But it really has happened before where I just thought, it's too much, I just can't do it, and I'll just feel myself sort of just, okay, I'm just gonna, maybe for a while, maybe forever, I don't know. And then somebody calls.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, oh, of course.
Yeah.
And then it's like it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
Because then the requests will come.
Mm-hmm.
They will come.
Yeah.
They will come.
Yeah.
And you don't turn away.
And we know that it is more a joyful way. When we tap back into it, we know actually our escape is like something that will be easier and more happy, but we realize it's not really, it doesn't work that way. That's another piece of it. Yes.
Part of what I kind of infer from what you're saying is we can get overwhelmed by the concept and the thoughts about it's this thing and it's big and it's, whereas when it's a person, when it's a needle, it's a being, of course. Yeah. And so it kind of reminds us moment to moment.
Moment to moment is a good point. Because it's always, our practice is always moment to moment. Sometimes this, you know, vast Buddhahood is like, but even if that's the case, it's one step at a time. Yes.
And then that's very transformational.
Yes.
If you're really feeling sorry for yourself and you're self-absorbed.
Yep.
You just can't imagine saving anybody. And then somebody does something that's really compassionate to you.
Yeah.
And you go, oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. And the Dalai Lama, this book, Mind in Comfort and Ease. Actually, it's Dzogchen commentaries by Dalai Lama, but it's a big section on bodhicitta. He talks in this section about like you have to love yourself in order to love others. After he gets like forget yourself, then maybe people questioned him or something, or he thought of it himself. He's like, well, you know, don't exclude yourself actually. So this is important to remember too. And also, I heard somewhere else recently along these lines that if some people would take it like if you start self-denigration, once you have this bodhisattva vow to say like, I can't do it, it's too much, one version is that actually is starting to like violate your vow from certain people's perspective. I thought, ooh, that's radical. I mean, we don't want to get like freaked out about that either, but like kind of like, we might feel I can't really do it, but that's kind of humble, right? It's like, no, actually, you vowed to do it. So it's like, it's okay to feel discouraged, but like, regenerate it, and this is as if your head's on fire. And then I thought this was quite interesting, kind of along the lines of like, me feeling discouraged, like, I should be able to do this after almost 10,000 hours. But here's the Dalai Lama says, I would like to make it clear at this point that I don't have bodhicitta in my heart to any extent at all. Whoa. This is like the guy who's like, we're counting on this guy is to be like the most compassionate bodhisattva on the planet, a lot of people would say. So, why is he saying this? It may seem as though I do because of my familiarity with the subject. But I don't. I certainly try to have bodhicitta. I hope to have it. And that hope is not entirely an empty one. So I think he's talking about its aspiration. Right? Yet it's still just a hope. I hope that I may become able to arouse true bodhicitta, but I don't experience it now. Nevertheless, even to have the inspiration to develop bodhicitta changes your mind, doesn't it? He says. So in a way, it's kind of like the aspiration for the aspiration. For the aspiration, for the aspiration. It's like that first step. And then he says, whether such an... I thought this was interesting too. Whether such an attitude of bodhicitta helps others or not is uncertain. If the circumstances are right, then another person can surely benefit from your having this attitude towards him or her. However, it could happen that the whole time that you're feeling compassion for someone, he or she does not appreciate it at all and even complains about you. There's no guarantee that your compassion can be communicated directly to someone else. So it's uncertain whether your compassion benefits others directly. But you, however, benefit immediately. So never make the error of thinking that others benefit from our cultivating compassion, but we do not. He really turns the tables. It might be just the opposite. And of course, we want it to benefit others, but I think he was saying, some people say, well, this is, how is this good does this do for me? If you still have that, well, it does great good. And then he says, in regards to all this, the view of emptiness is of vital importance. If this quest is to bring true benefit to others and realize this awakening, we have to understand what awakening means and what benefit to others means, and understand that this ultimate benefit is this nirvana, this total freedom from suffering. So without understanding that, we maybe can't really fully get into this. And this, it depends on the view of emptiness at the beginning, in the middle, and in the long term. So that's another topic. Yes. Any other thoughts? Yes.
Yes, I have a question. It's something I don't understand. It's, why would you aspire to something that is already realized in practice? Why would you be thinking about something you wish you were able to do, or you aspire to, that can only be done in practice?
It can only be done in practice as opposed to...
Wishing.
Oh. You say, like, why not just do the practice?
Right. It's something that, compassion is only, it's something that can only be perceived if you realize it.
Yeah. But I think the aspiration is like, again, in my experience, the example comes up is like, again, it's about removing these obscurations. So I often find myself feeling like, wow, I'm really like caught up in greed, hate, or delusion, and I notice that, and then I remember this vow, and I'm like, actually, I'd really like to let go of this now, but I actually feel like I can't. It's really strong. It's got a grip on me, and then I arouse this. I really want to be able to let go of this, and I can't quite yet, but I really want to, and that wanting to actually then starts being like, why do you want to? And especially, this is where the compassion part actually like fuels the practice, because I feel like, I want to just so I can be free. Well, I don't even care about me anymore when I'm in a mood like that. Well, actually, there's like, this world needs like me to like let go of this greed, hate, and delusion. And there's, you know, to really, you know, what else could be more important? And then I start remembering like that. It's sometimes hard to do if I'm in a mood. I get in moods sometimes, and But then it's like, it's almost like reasoning with myself, like remembering impermanence, remembering how openness, like, may I just, like, I can feel my heart is just encrusted by this cape, by this hard shell of, like, my habitual tendencies, like, may I just relax them. It's like an aspiration, and then they start to relax, right? So you could say, you could have that be an instant thing. You could say, may I just relax them? And as soon as you say it, especially if they're not that strong, sometimes as soon as you say it, oh yeah, it just the practice is immediate. But you could say, even say, any practice actually always starts with an intention. Or everything that we do all day long is based on an intention. We say we're automatically doing things, but actually there's an, every moment the Buddha teaches, there's some conscious or often unconscious intention. So it's kind of like becoming aware of the intention and then like training it in this particular way. Like, does that make sense? Aspiration is kind of like the intention that precedes every action. So it's not, I think we might say, I aspire to have compassion, that might be a little bit off, because I propose again is that compassion's already here. It's more like I aspire to be able to let go of this like grip that's blocking it. Yes, last question.
Last question. So,
for the benefit of all beings, tight and short.
Yeah, and clarity. So, the Bodhisattva sees emptiness, he sees the impossibility of accomplishing the saving of all beings, and he does it anyway. So that's this to me turns the idea of even saying, I know I can do this, I can fulfill this vow, which we also paradoxically know is impossible, leads me to the conclusion or to the sense that when we're talking about practice in our life and all the vows, that's a way of living.
It's a direction.
It's a way of being alive. It doesn't depend on you saving everybody or anything else, because that's impossible. But we accept this way of living as if we could.
I was talking with someone about the precepts earlier too, and it seems like if we say like I have to like, you know, keep this precept exactly, it's again, it's impossible. I think with all the precepts, if we look really carefully, it's like impossible. But it's a direction. We're just continually going in that direction. Well, if we say, well, I can't do it completely, so I won't do it at all, or it doesn't matter, then we fall as a bodhisattva, right?
Way seems to be really hitting my mind that we're living the way of Zen.
The way, mm-hmm. And in our tradition, we might say impossible. I think in some of these, you know, Mahayana sutras, it's kind of like, in a way, you're generating this like, almost like magical thinking maybe, that it actually is possible. The only way though it's possible is to become these, you know, three bodies of a Buddha, where you can like, it's just almost inconceivable how much benefit that is. We might say, that's just somebody's like, imaginative musing, somebody's inspiration after doing a lot of zazen. Wouldn't this be cool? So whether we believe it or not, I think that is just classically sometimes part of the story, is that this Buddha is, it's possible to save all beings. And maybe in Zen we would say, without getting that cosmic, we'd say, I think this is where the emptiness part comes in. Right? It's like, if all of it is really like a dream anyway, then actually a lot is possible. That doesn't usually seem possible.
Everything.
Yeah. Maybe it actually is possible. But not the way we think. May the precious mind of Bodhicitta arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen, may it never decrease, but increase further and further. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are innocent.